From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor in Washington, and Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. History in Singapore, where President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met, what resulted, and what happens next. In the United States, the fight over immigration continues, and there has been another round of political primaries here. What do the results suggest about both the big November midterm elections and the political outlook for President Trump himself? And finally, and on a sad note, we'll pay tribute to a longtime panelist on this program, our dear friend Orrin Dorrell. We regret to announce that Orrin has passed away, and we're going to dedicate this program to him, in fact. So let's start with the week's big story, a giant story, in fact, President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un meeting in Singapore. Just these images of these two men shaking hands, just absolutely stunning. No sitting president, Tracy, has ever met any leader of North Korea. But what actually came of their meeting?
Yes, that's correct. Those images were startling. The flags, the North Korean flag on the same level with the U.S. flag. No previous sitting president has met with a North Korean leader. They refused to, generally. I mean, North Korea has wanted this for a long time. Past American presidents felt like it would be rewarding that government to sit down with a leader before there were, you know, serious steps towards controlling the nuclear program. But Trump decided to go the other way, President Trump. And what came of it in the end, after all of the fanfare, was a pretty limited and vague agreement, 4 points in which they rehash the same goals that have been at the center of previous agreements between the United States or the West and North Korea, and that have ultimately collapsed every time. The Americans say that the North Koreans routinely cheat on these agreements, and so there are a lot of doubts about how far this one will go. It states that they will agree on forming a new relationship between the two countries, a lasting and stable peace on the peninsula, which I think alludes to the fact that formally the United States and North Korea are still at war, and North Korea commits to what they called in the document a complete denuclearization, omitting the standard mantra, really, of the United States of verifiable and irreversible denuclearization. Secretary of State Pompeo insists that is part of the understanding, but the words are not there. And then finally, repatriation of remains of American soldiers who were killed in the war, which again is a program that has gone off and on for decades. The next step is Pompeo is going to have to do a lot of hard work for weeks and months and perhaps years to get some details, meat on the bones, as everyone says, to get actual steps of how North Korea will, first of all, acknowledge what it has in terms of its arsenal, and then open up to inspectors, start dismantling, and then how that will be verified over the years, if indeed the negotiations go as the United States wants them to.
You know, Michael, Tracy brings up a good point that these North Koreans have made promises like this in the past. I mean, going back to, I think, 1992 or so, have never kept their word. The question is, why should we believe them now?
There's no good answer to that question. There's obviously a confidence that President Trump has in his ability to cajole, coerce, maybe even seduce, you know, some of these leaders on the world stage. And look, the promises that came out of this, as you said, are very vague, more akin to something that comes out of maybe sort of couples therapy than, you know, an international summit. It's like, I agree to listen. I agree to talk and be better. It's there's not very much meat on the bones, as you allude to. So, yes, given the past track record, we can probably predict that there will be at least some twists and turns and probably some backtracking on some of the expectations that aren't specifically put down on a piece of paper. Now, you have Mike Pompeo right now as the CIA director. You also have John Bolton, who's behind the scenes.
Secretary of State.
Former CIA director, excuse me. You have a team of people who isn't necessarily on the same page. And even during this summit, you had President Trump putting things on the table that have never been put on the table, even in talking about these types of negotiations in terms of pulling back from military exercises. This was a surprise to the South Koreans and even to the American delegation. I mean, nobody knew that he was going to say that. So the unpredictable nature of the Trump administration makes it all the more likely that something is going to happen that pulls the North Koreans back from any commitment that they've made.
So kind of a cavalier approach, sort of a vague results from this.
Yeah.
Right? You were going to add something.
Yeah, no, what's interesting about the halting of the military exercises is that Trump used words that are used by the North Koreans to describe those exercises, provocative war games.
Yeah.
You know, that is the lexicon of North Korea and China. And so there's a lot of suspicion that maybe this was planted by the Chinese, this idea. It was stunning, as you say, to a lot of the Pentagon was surprised by this. I think Trump and his supporters would say, you know, explaining how vague this initial agreement is, will say, well, it's just the beginning. You know, there's a long process, which is fine and a good point. But then you don't declare that the North Korean nuclear threat is over, as President Trump has also done.
Well, you can't declare that it's over either, because and this is sort of where these comparisons with the Iran deal that he walked away from come in. At least with Iran, they agreed to reduce their uranium enrichment by something like 98% and keep it at levels well below bomb grade. I don't want to get into the technical weeds here, but also they agreed to stop producing plutonium. I mean, really hardcore things like that. There's been no talk of anything like this with these North Koreans, right? So we're a long way from what Trump calls a denuclearization.
Yeah, and a key difference is Iran actually didn't have a nuclear bomb or nuclear warheads, and it's estimated that Kim probably has up to 60. Right. So it's a huge, huge difference.
And on this one thing, let me ask you both this even term denuclearization means different things to different people. I think this is a really important thing that people aren't focusing on. When we say denuclearization from the American standpoint, we mean North Korea is going to get rid of their nuclear weapons. That's not what it means in North Korea, right? In North Korea, it means us ending our nuclear guarantees, security guarantees of South Korea, right? We can't even agree on what the term means. So how do you come up with a deal when you can't even agree on what the basic terms mean?
Well, you talk it out. You know, and this is where extended diplomacy comes in. So there needs to be an extended round of talk after talk after talk and nailing down these types of points. And you say you don't want to get into the weeds, but this is what has to happen. There are many, many weeds. It's a field of weeds out there between where we stand now and what anybody calls denuclearization. So having competent people that are willing to do this over a long period of time is essential. We don't know who those people are. We don't know who the POC on the other side, who's the contact point on the North Korean side. Who is that person? And are they of the same mind as the people that we have on our side, beginning with Mike Pompeo? It's a very good question. What is denuclearization?
The other thing that helped me understand this, Tracy, is that it's not just nuclear weapons that they have. It's believed that they also have this very robust chemical weapons capacity, biological weapons capacity, and to kind of connect the dots here, haven't some of their chemical weapons wound up in the hands of Bashar al-Assad in Syria? No talk about their chemical and biological weapons, which are a clear and present danger as well.
Correct. He's thought to have quite an extensive chemical and biological weapons arsenal, which is, again, why the key, you know, building foundation in all of this is for North Korea to declare what it has, because the West does not know. We do not know all that he has. And not only have some of these weapons shown up in Syria, you know, he's used nerve agents to kill his half-brother, in Malaysia. So
At the airport.
So yes, this stuff has shown up in many places. And we're not even beginning to talk about human rights and his use of weapons on his own people, his own family. So there's a lot there yet. The difference, one difference is perhaps that this is a new younger leader who is interested. He's pretty confident now. He's got a nuclear arsenal. He can now look to other improvements in his country's economy. He's certainly gotten the international recognition he was hoping for. We can no longer talk about an isolated, remote, unknown regime. I mean, this is now in his eyes, and I think he's got, you know, reason to think this, a recognized nuclear power.
Well, that alone was a huge concession. Is that fair to say?
Yes, huge.
Concession from the president.
Again, what lesson does this really give to people on the world stage? If you're trying to get countries not to start and complete a nuclear program, what it does, it's a big advertisement to me of starting and creating a nuclear program. This is how you get into the club. And that was the whole point, part and parcel, aside from his own internal security for this regime, for UN, is to be on that stage. It's known that if you are a nuclear player, you get to a certain point, and that's just been justified by this guy. Now, FDR once said, and I love this quote, he said this about Yalta, it is permitted in time of grave danger to walk with the devil until you've crossed the bridge. And there's another one that says, he who dines with the devil had better have a long spoon. And I think that President Trump would be well advised to think about those things. I know that he likes to get into these relationships with what would everyone would say are sort of dodgy characters. And he feels that he can hold his own with them, that he has a way to build a personal rapport with these people. But I think that there's a difference between an understanding of money and deal making and an understanding of power and influence. And these people are very, very practiced in the art of power and influence. And I hope that we have the people advising the president who understand the mindset of these despotic leaders and allow us not to end up in a situation where you're worse off than where you started.
So just to sum up here before we go on, they still have their nuclear weapons. And Secretary of State Pompeo says it's his goal that they can get rid of these North Korean weapons in, 2.5 years? So in other words, this is all very vague. We've got a long way to go.
I guess the most positive thing we can say is that we have stepped back from what many thought was the brink of war with the inflammatory rhetoric coming from both Kim and Trump, and we have backed off of that. So I think there is less of a threat of war right now.
Well, that in and of itself, I think, is some amount of a progress. Well, let's pause for a short break here. More issues in the news in just a moment.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program from iTunes, it's free. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor in Washington, and Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. One of the biggest issues here in the United States today is immigration. Who can enter this country, members of their family, and what do we do with those who arrive without documentation? In other words, so-called illegal immigrants. Michael, there's this bill that is working its way through Congress now that sort of looks to be a compromise between the conservative and the moderate faction of the Republican Party. It would, if you read it, it looks like it would make pretty sweeping changes to our immigration system. Tell us briefly, what is in the bill, and what would it do for immigrants trying to come here?
Well, a large part of it deals with the Dreamers. The ideology of the Trump administration blocking all immigration at this point, they're basically against any immigration at all. It's a even legal immigration. And this is a philosophical point that got President Trump elected. Let's make no bones about it. This is a feeling that goes throughout the country. So it's about making an established set of rules that is fair and open and honest and allows immigration to happen in the spirit of the American promise, allowing people to come across the border in reasonable numbers. And we have this situation now where we have the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions saying that issues like gang violence and issues like domestic abuse, which were previously grounds for asylum in the United States, these are no longer grounds, according to a ruling that was made. In addition to having those rulings set, He's also invoking the Bible as a reason for taking young children away from their mothers, separating families. Aside from the moral issues, it creates a tremendous logistical problem in the sense that in each one of these families are separated. It creates an individual case, sometimes for parents and children, sometimes for each individual parent and each individual child. It's a complete logistical nightmare in addition to being a moral outrage.
Well, I was going to bring that up in just a minute, but let's talk about this issue, Tracy, of it's a big controversy here where federal agents along our border with Mexico, people who are trying to come into the country without documentation, these agents are now taking children, sometimes as young as 1 year old, 52 weeks old, taking them away from their mothers and fathers, putting them in an entirely different location. Now, the White House says, well, we're just enforcing the law, but this actually isn't the law.
No, it's not the law. And at one point, I believe President Trump tried to say, well, it's the Democrats who created this, which is just not at all the case. This is the result of the Trump administration zero tolerance so-called policy. And yes, some of these children are toddlers. Reportedly, hundreds have been, they've lost track of them. We've seen reports of parents being deported and sent back to usually Central America without their children. And they have to work to find their children to be reunited with them. So I can only imagine the trauma of that. This is one feature that has unusually united some conservatives and liberals, Democrats and Republicans. There's not a lot of support for tearing children from their parents. And even some of the conservative evangelical groups, Catholic groups, have come out against this. And I think that is what is going to finally get the administration to maybe back down a little bit on this. This compromise bill that you mentioned is one way to do away with that aspect, but the bill also includes massive funding for a border wall, which most experts on the border don't think will have much of an impact on security, yet, you know, Trump campaigned on it, and just the general effort to reduce all immigration, which I think a lot of Democrats and some others have trouble with.
And the other issue about immigration, by the way, to kind of go off a little bit of a tangent here, is that we have huge labor shortages in this country, and yet you have the administration trying to crack down even on legal immigrants. Sometimes it's hard to connect the dots on some of these things.
If we had a reasonable governing center, you know, in our legislative body, you would be able to look at this as a policy issue and come to reasonable conclusions about not only an immigration policy, but about guest worker policies. This is an issue in terms of labor. It's a huge issue for business and for our national economy. Everyone knows that this labor force is very much needed. But because it's become an ideological issue, you can't get to reasonable solutions. There's much more political capital to be gained from confrontation with the opposing party than compromise with the opposing party.
So some of these problems simply aren't being solved then. We just continue to talk and argue hide in our corners, and we're not getting these problems solved. Well, let's move on here. This week, there was a big round of primaries here in the United States. Now, for our global listeners, political primaries when voters pick the candidates that will appear on the ballot in November for races like governors and senators and the House of Representatives. It's sort of like kind of a weeding out process. Sum up the night. Who wants to go first here? Sort of elections all over the country, Michael.
Roger that. Well, I see it as in these primaries on the Republican side, it's a test of the power of Trumpism. You have a president who's running somewhere between 70% and 80% popularity in his own party, based on which poll you want to listen to, and I'm sure in the White House it's the 80% side. So, if you are going to run as an incumbent, you have to not run on your voting record. It's not good enough. You have to run on your loyalty and fealty to the President of the United States. And if you do not display that, you will be blowtorched by his Twitter account, and you have the possibility of losing. So that's what happens on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, you have this sort of referendum that's going on in the Democratic Party between standard Democratic ideology in terms of policy and the new progressivism that was ushered in by Bernie Sanders. So that's what's going on in the two-party primaries, because, as you said, each one has their own side, and then those two will meet in November. the elections that we got were fascinating, the winners that we got. And I think they tell you a lot about what is going to happen in November.
So, Tracy, the November is still about 5.5 months off from where we are. Is it too early to say what this means about November? How are things looking for each party, in your view?
In the current political climate, I think, yes, I think it is too early because things are changing back and forth all the time. But I think Democrats who thought they were going to have an easy time are starting to be a little more chagrined and are going to have to work a little harder. I do think, you know, there was a lot of talk about this shows that you can't criticize Trump, you'll get lost, you'll be forced into a loss. However, let's remember these are the primaries, and traditionally, even before these days, primaries tend to go to the extremes on either party, as Michael was saying. And so I think we have to, you know, take this with a grain of salt about what it does tell us. And I think there are many months yet to find out.
All right. Well, finally, we want to take a moment to remember a longtime panelist here on Issues in the News. Orrin Dorrell was a longtime foreign affairs correspondent for USA Today, which is one of the biggest newspapers here in the United States. And we regret to inform you that Orrin has passed away. He was 53 years old. He leaves behind his loving wife, Virginia, Ginny Knapp Dorrell. They had two sons, Malcolm, who was 12 years old, and Leo, who was 11 years old. Michael, you know, his wife said that Orrin became a journalist because it made him feel like he was making a difference in the world. You knew him pretty well. He did make a difference, didn't he?
He did make a difference in the world. You know, he came to journalism later in life. He wasn't like a cub reporter or anything like that. And I think that the fact that he came to it as a fully grown man gave him a unique sense of, this is hard. It really gave him a sense of wisdom and calm perspective that was very unique to his style. I never heard him raise his voice. Very considered man. He was always interested in the story. He had that natural intellectual curiosity that every good reporter needs. But he wasn't only interested in the story. He was interested in your story. And I think that's what got him to be so close to the people he needed to get to the truth of the matter. And also what made him so easy to connect to so many people. He was interested in you. And I don't think I ever had a conversation with him that didn't end with, well, we got to get together soon. I think every single conversation I ever had with him was like that. He was a great journalist, a great husband and father, and just a lovely man.
And just in a general sense, Tracy, you know, this curiosity that we all have as journalists, we're storytellers. We like to go to places that are sometimes war zones or disaster zones, tough, unpleasant places, and tell stories. And boy, he was really good at that.
Yes, telling stories, telling, you know, speaking truth to power, which is one of the main things we as journalists do. I think Orrin was very good at that, at, you know, fact-checking the powers that be. He would come to the State Department and, you know, he wouldn't ask a question every time, as many do, but he would ask smart questions, you know, really smart questions. When I would, which I rarely do, I said, gee, I should have asked that. You know, it was that good that he would, had it really thought out. And yeah, and as Michael said, you know, he came to journalism late, and I remember that I think his wife said he really felt like he was finally in his element and loved what he was doing.
Yeah.
Can I just skip one thing before we go? Auden is my favorite poet, and he wrote a farewell to W.B. Yeats, and I'd just like to share a part of that poem, if I may, because we talk about loss and we talk about death and tragedy so much on this show, but when it hits home personally, it really gives you an opportunity to feel something, and I just, maybe this stanza could help describe what we're all feeling in this room. But in the importance and noise of tomorrow, when the brokers are roaring like beasts on the floor of the bourse, and the poor have the sufferings to which they are fairly accustomed, and each in the cell of himself is almost convinced of his freedom, a few thousand will think of this day as one thinks of a day when one did something slightly unusual. What instruments we have agree, the day of his death was a dark, cold day. I will miss Orrin Dorrell.
Well, as we all will, and he really did make a difference, and we'd like to extend our deepest condolences to his wonderful family. He will be missed. He's one of those people who is just irreplaceable. I think. We're going to have to end it right there. Our thanks to Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times and Michael Williams of CBS News. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer, Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you for joining us.